From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. We have a busy night ahead of us. A little bit later, Clint Van Zandt, you know, Clint as a retired FBI agent, hostage negotiator, will be here to talk about that case of Jimmy Lee Dykes in Alabama. After that, get this story. He's was a senior official with the Canadian provincial government, actually the province that I live in. His wife is murdered in 2000. He's arrested for it in 2008. A jury finds him not guilty in 2012, and now he's writing a book about his experience in jail, and that's Mark Stolbe will be here. We're going to start off with one of our favorite guests here in the program, author Fred Rosen. Fred has a new book that he's working on, Sisters in Murder. I'm not sure if it's about the Kardashian girls or not, but we'll ask Fred. Fred, how are you?
I'm great, Dana. I hadn't thought about the Kardashians.
Yeah, I think that would be great. You do an expose on the Kardashians. You know, let's spend 28 seconds on the Kardashians. Don't you feel sorry for Bruce Jenner, or is it just me?
I feel a little sorry for him, but I always wondered why he had that strange plastic surgery.
Exactly. Yeah.
I never could quite figure that one out,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know. But you know what? They're doing what you and I aren't doing, and that's making a gazillion dollars. And, well, whatever. So what have you been up to? I haven't had you on for a while.
Well, I'm working on a new book called Sisters in Murder, and I think it's a pretty good tale. It's about three sisters out of Georgia, the Augusta area, and of various ages, from 50 down into their 40s. And one of them, who's the oldest sister, Kathy, was kept for 20 years by a man named Ron Vincy, and this takes place in the Fort Lauderdale area. And one night, she had a little problem, Dana. She shot him. She stabbed him, she slit his throat, she bludgeoned him, she threw him down the stairs, and then she wanted to dump him in the Atlantic. and so, you know, because of who I am, I said, well, this is a very strange situation. And I looked into it, and it turns out that she has two other sisters, and both of those sisters had been involved in various ways with Phil Spector.
Wow, okay.
And it testified at the Phil Spector trial.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so I got into that because I wanted to know why it was that she killed this dude. And that's part of what the book's about. And, that's really what the book's about, because there's a number of different motives. And her trial is coming up later this month in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, we'll be talking to you more about that. That is interesting because I covered the Phil Spector trial, and it's going to be interesting. We don't want to give too much of it away, but speaking of which, crazy stories, what's your thoughts on this Jodi Arias, and speaking of slitting throats and shooting someone?
Well, you're the second person to ask me about that. What's my thoughts on it? My thought on it is this. I think that these are the most extreme cases of women who are in situations of apparent or alleged abuse. And but the bottom line here is this: if I remember correctly, Miss Arias is in Texas,
right?
And that creates its own little bit of problems, obviously, because in Texas they execute. And so, I think that, to me, the discussion regarding that case and any other case that's a capital case in Texas goes toward the discussion of the death penalty.
Yep.
And the way it is used, quite frankly, I feel indiscriminately in that state. So, to me, this again, this kind of a case throws a light on that whole alleged criminal justice system in the state of Texas. You realize, of course, I just PO'd the entire state of Texas. Only I could do that.
Absolutely.
But you know, seriously, I mean, the death penalty machinery is such that it is exactly that. It's machinery. And so it doesn't become a question of what the case is about what the facts are, but whether the person is going to get the death penalty and if they're going to use it, which, again, they more often than not do.
Well, it will be interesting, author Fred Rosen's here, to see what happens. And all the testimony heard on the stand the last few days is, it's pretty easy to figure out they're trying to save her bacon instead of frying her bacon or whatever they do in Texas these days. You as the author, turn on the TV or open the newspaper or whatever. There's always a story. This Jimmy Lee Dykes, and we're going to do that next segment, goes on, shoots the kid on the bus and the hostage taking and all that sort of stuff. Now he's gone to wherever guys like him go. The little boy is safe. But do you ever wonder, will there ever be a lack of stories for you to write about? Seems like something every day.
Well, that's of course, absolutely. The answer is there'll never be a lack of stories. I wrote a book called The Historical Atlas of American Crime, which looked at crime in America from 1587 to the present. And I looked at it from a number of different points of view, from a sociological point of view, from the point of view of how crime expanded as the United States expanded. So there's nothing new happening. I mean, this has all happened before, and I can point to the specific instances. So it does, again, there's a case in, the Jimmy Lee Dykes case, for example. I can point to the one of the first cases in American criminal history where a schizophrenic killed a baby in the Philadelphia area in the late 1790s. So there's nothing new. I think the only thing that's new is the technology that's involved,
yeah.
And perhaps the reaction to the actual crimes and how law enforcement reacts, and of course the technology and that law enforcement can bring to this. I mean, you'll be talking to Mr. Van Zandt in a couple of minutes, but you know what I was fascinated about was how the FBI stormed quote unquote the bunker,
mm-hmm.
And you know that of course is interesting, and the fact that it was a bunker. And all of that, but my question always becomes in these cases is, okay, we got ourselves a nut, pretty obviously. So my question is, what were the warning signs?
Yeah.
And we know that there were warning signs, and who missed them? And that's my big problem with any of these cases, is that no one ever takes responsibility.
Yep, no, for sure. Fred, when we talk about cases, and something you and I have talked about before, and I want to ask you for an update again, it's about Ray Gray.
Yes.
And what's going on. An individual has been in jail for a long, long time, and you've been working hard to try and get him out. Tell my audience about Ray Gray.
Well, first, let's thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Ray Gray is a man who was convicted of a murder that he did not commit over 40 years ago in Detroit, Michigan. And he was convicted on the basis of being fingered by an ex-girlfriend who claimed that he was involved in the murder of this drug dealer. And what occurred, and he was actually someplace else during this period of time. He was convicted, he went to jail, and we actually have an affidavit from one of the two holdup men who actually committed the crime. The man's name is Charles Matthews, and this affidavit was not allowed by the Wayne County officials in Detroit to be presented as evidence because they told Mr. Matthews, if you testify to the truth of this affidavit that you were involved, we will prosecute you. And therefore, Mr. Matthews took the First Amendment and decided not to testify. And as a result, Mr. Gray has been in jail all of these years. And what's happening right now is that the Detroit Crime Commission, which is an independent body, has taken up his case, and they are trying to free him. And they provide a support to local law enforcement, and they take on cases involving people who are innocently convicted of crimes, as Ray was. And so now they are working with an attorney in the Detroit area to try to bring this finally to some resolution where Ray gets out, but it's a very, very difficult path to hoe. And it's been a very, very, very frustrating time. I've been working on it for 6 years. Ray's wife, Barb, who's listening in, has been working on it for 30 years. And it's very frustrating, but we have a lot of hope that between the Crime Commission and those of us who are devoted to Ray's case, that we'll be able to eventually free him.
Looks like Ray Gray was and still is a hell of an artist.
Ray Gray is one of the premier African-American artists in the United States. He was, at the time of his conviction, he was going to art school while pursuing a career as a professional boxer. And when he got into prison, the way that he's coped is to take up his canvas and his paints. And he has continued to paint in prison. And his stuff has been exhibited, his paintings in galleries all through the United States. It's much in demand. And prisoners as well would love having Ray's stuff in their cell. And he's quite an artist, and he's a very soulful man. And what makes Ray such a unique person, I believe, is that if Ray had done what the authorities wanted, which was to confess to this crime which he didn't commit, he would have been out. He refuses to do it because he didn't do it. He will not do it.
You know, it's interesting, and a little later on, I'm going to have a fella on the show that spent time in jail, accused of murdering his wife, and now he's writing or has written a book about his time and what we call up here remand. You used the term cope. Besides the person in jail, the family, you mentioned Ray's wife, 30 years, that's an awful long time. Is it not
40.
Just... Or 40.
Oh, okay, 30, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
He's been in 40, she's been working on 30. You know, regardless, whether it's 30, 40, or 6 months, how do you not just give up?
Oh, boy. How do you just not give up? Well, the truth is, I think there are moments where people do give up, and those are very depressing moments. But I think what happens is... I honestly believe that what happens is that God enters into it.
Yeah.
I think that people, when you have that belief in a higher power, you believe that that higher power is going to help. And I think that what happens is that in those moments, that belief gets you through those moments, Dana, and then... A couple of moments down the line, other people start believing in the person's innocence, as I began to believe and know of Ray's innocence, and it snowballs, and there's a momentum, and I think that as a result of that, it continues to create the hope, and quite frankly that the system will work. And so it's a combination of things that you really do believe that if a person is innocent, that eventually they are going to be proved innocent. The problem is we're running out of time, and as a person gets older, as you know, as we all know, you know, various problems set in physically and such. But we remain hopeful that we'll be able to get through this. But I do think that the belief in the higher power, and I think also the fact of people banding together for a common cause and a common good cause. That's the sort of belief, as Dr. King made clear, that can change the world.
Yeah, for sure. Fred Rosen's here. Author, he has a book coming out soon, Sisters in Murder. Click on the link in the show notes, you'll learn more about Fred. I'm going to throw one at you here a little bit and see if I can get you to talk about Gary Hilton.
Oh, my God.
And the...
My
buddy. You know, if you don't want to, I understand, but...
Oh, no, I'm more than happy to talk about it.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Say that three times real fast. Anyway, is your story about Gary Hilton and the victim, Meredith Emerson. I'm going to throw you the ball, Fred. Go with it.
Well, I wrote a book called Trails of Death, which is out. It came out 2 years ago. It's about Gary Hilton, who's a serial killer. And Gary's last victim was Meredith Emerson, a 24-year-old Georgia woman who was hiking on Blood Mountain on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2008. Gary took a prisoner, held her for 3 days, actually from the 1st to the 4th, so it was actually almost 4 days, until he finally bludgeoned her, and then he beheaded her after death in order to obscure identification. What happened was I wrote the book, but prior to doing that, I was working on an article for Hustler magazine. I was working for Larry Flint,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to get both crime scene photos and reports of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. When they found out I was working for Larry, they made a cause célèbre out of it. I was condemned on the floor of the Georgia Senate, so was Larry. They passed a law which prevents journalists from ever getting any materials like this in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew at the time that there was a reason why they came down on us so hard. And eventually a source in Georgia slipped me reports that I had not been given by the authorities. And when I got the reports, I realized that the GBI had completely messed up in their investigation and at various points. And I wrote an article under assignment for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the piece was going to come out. And a couple of weeks ago, the GBI spokesperson told my editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that if they published that story, they were going to cut them off, meaning they would not allow them any more access, official access, to the GBI, and which, of course, would be devastating to a local newspaper.
Right.
However, the newspaper decided to cave to them, and that's exactly what happened. They killed my story, and I said to my editor, what are you going to do the next time they come calling?
Yep.
And he didn't have an answer to it. And so the moral of the story is that, not everybody has the courage of the New York Times, or for that matter, the Washington Post. And sometimes, corporate interests and especially government interests outweigh the right of the people to get the truth, and that's what happened in this case.
I was just about to say, whether it's this story or the next one for you or one 5 years from now, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, like they like to say, sometimes can be outweighed by Big Brother or threats of whatever. How do you, as the author, react to that? Do you just suck it up and go on to the next one, or what will Fred Rosen do?
What I do, this is the first time this ever happened to me like this. I've had other instances where I've had difficulty more with people threatening me, bad guys usually,
right,
that I'm ready. But the answer is that I'm already looking into publishing this same story in another publication.
That's what I figured you'd do.
The truth is going to come out. I'm not going to let it go, because the fact of the matter is, if this organization, the GBI, had done its job, I believe that Meredith Emerson would have come back alive. They waited over 7 hours from the time they knew Gary Hilton was their suspect before they released the information. 7 hours. And it gets even worse than that. There were other situations during the course of this kidnapping that the actual timeline is not what they say it was. So there's only one thing you can do, which is if you're going to be a journalist, you've got to go after the best obtainable version of the truth and keep going, regardless of the personal consequences. What are they going to do to me?
Yeah.
Seriously, I'll tell you, Dana, if I was in Georgia, I'd be worried.
Yeah.
But I'm not in Georgia, and I'm not planning on going to Georgia anytime soon. And, I feel like as journalists, if we don't PO people at some point, we're not doing our job.
And that's what it's all about. It's the truth. And Fred Rosen is a man to tell the truth, and I knew you'd answer it that way. So, what's next, Sisters in Murder, and what else you got on the go?
Well, I'm going to be doing Sisters in Murder, and I'm actually working on a. That's one that I'm doing, and I'm the other thing that's happening is I hope to be publishing sometime later this year the first ebook of Lobster Boy, which was a book I wrote a while back that's been out of print for about 7 years, and I've acquired the rights back, and I think I have a publisher, and we're going to put up the ebook, so people will finally be able to read this book again. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I might add that my agent sold the film rights to Sam Worthington, who is a movie star who was in Avatar, and they've done a script, and there's a possibility they're going to make it into a movie.
Wow.
Yeah, which would be, you know, real cool. You're coming to the premiere, Dana.
It'd be fantastic.
You'd have a great time, you know?
Absolutely. I've always told people that you and I are like the Starsky and Hutch of talk radio, so nobody... I don't think we could slide over top of the car like they used to, but we'll go out and we'll kick some butt and take some names for sure.
That's wonderful. And I think, by the way, I was thinking about this, I think you may be the only police officer in North America with his own radio show.
I think I am, yeah.
I think that's a heck of a distinction.
I think I am. Fred, always a pleasure, my friend. Talk to you soon.
All right, Danny, take care of yourself.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fred Rosen. He tells it like it is, and make sure and check out his book, Sisters in Murder. All of his books are spine tinglers, and I'll go to that movie premiere for sure. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back in a couple of minutes with Clint Van Zandt, another guy that's been around the block for sure, a former FBI agent, hostage negotiator, with some cred there. He negotiated with David Koresh at Waco, and we're going to talk about Jimmie Lee Dykes, this whole situation in Alabama. Thank God the little boy is safe. What happened? What about the negotiators? What about the media? The dopey media is really pushing the idea. They want to know more about this camera that was used to, see inside this bunker. And does the media even have a right to know that kind of stuff? And then after that, Mark Stobie. That's a local story with international flavor. It was covered all over the place. He's a government official here in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, arrested and charged for the murder of his wife, was found not guilty, was acquitted by a jury of his peers, and has now written a book, Lessons from Remand, where he talks about his time waiting in jail to see what happens, about going to court and some of the experiences he had, one in particular with a biker, and it's fascinating. I didn't bring Mark Stobie on the show tonight to accuse him of murder because the jury has said he's not guilty, but I did bring Mark Stobie on the program tonight to talk about his experience in jail. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Clint Van Zandt. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. A semi-regular guest on the program, Dr. Clint Van Zandt. His webpage, livesecure.org, is one for you to check out about safety and how to protect your loved ones. Clint is a former FBI agent, a hostage negotiator, profiler, and I thought I'd bring him on the show tonight to talk about Jimmie Lee Dykes. Clint, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back with you.
It's quite the story. I know you've been busy with the media on the Today Show this morning. What are your thoughts on Dykes? We'll get into the actual background in a minute, but just briefly some facts on Jimmie Lee Dykes and what happened.
Yeah, you look at Dykes, just the man himself. You know, this is a guy in his mid-60s, a military veteran, Navy, Vietnam, military from about 63 to 69. Been a truck driver, had raised at least one child, a strange relationship. More and more over the years has become more estranged from society, more of an anti-government type of person, become more of a survivalist, bought this piece of land within the last couple of years and went about building an underground bunker that evidently was going to serve two purposes. Number one, for storms or tornadoes, and number two, I guess, for his belief when that day of reckoning came and civil insurrection, the government or Obama or somebody came to get his guns or food or something else, and he would go and hunker down in that bunker. And I think that because he got arrested about the 22nd, 23rd of December for firing a gun allegedly over the head of his neighbors to keep them away from his property, and as you know, it's been touted on television that he beat a dog to death with a lead pipe that came on his property, obviously not winning friends and influencing his neighbors there. But I think that when he took that little boy hostage, when he went on that bus, that was the day before he was to appear in court on those menacing charges with firearm. And in his likely paranoid mind, he may well have believed that this was, you know, in his self-fulfilling prophecy, the government, this is when the government's going to get me, they're going to throw the book at me, they're going to use this as an occasion to take away my freedom. And I think he made, even though he took 2 years to build the bunker, I think he probably took a day or two to make the decision at most, that he wanted to have some shield between himself and the authorities, which in his mind all of a sudden became taking a child off that bus. And perhaps he did that too, looking at the Sandy Hook shooting situation, yeah, figuring that if he had a child as a hostage, that that would give him a national platform to talk about his anti-government and likely highly paranoid views and share that information to the public. It kind of, in his own mind, maybe he saw himself as kind of a Paul Revere, and he was going to tell everybody that the government is coming and they're going to get your guns.
Clint Van Zandt's here, and what we heard from the Sheriff's Department was that he had a message. In fact, it slipped out a little bit when they were doing their release, and we'll get into that, being a media spokesman in something like this. When you get that, and we can go back to Waco and David Koresh, yeah, and the wackos that want that media time, you as the negotiator, do you... how do you work around that for the layperson to understand? You have someone with a diluted idea of something, and they want to spew it out to the public. How do you negotiate with them to try and convince them that, yeah, okay, we'll do that, just let your hostage go?
Sure, and as a negotiator, that's a good thing if they want something from me. I mean, your worst-case scenario is obviously somebody says, I want nothing from you, I'm going to die and take my hostage with me,
right,
period. I have nothing to say. You either want them to have a demand, in essence, I want to talk to the media, I want a TV reporter, which I've had in prison riots, and then you develop a negotiation strategy, as you well know, where you kind of hold that up in a positive way. You dangle that in front of them and you say, you know what, I'm going to make that happen. In fact, the whole world wants to hear. You've got the whole world's attention. They're all waiting to hear what you have to say. And here's a Polaroid picture of the media about a block away. They're all set with their TV antennas and microphones. Here's a picture so you can see Jimmy Lee. And all you have to do to make that happen is you let that little boy come out. You come out and you and I will walk over there, stand in front of the cameras, and I guarantee you, you will have the opportunity to tell the world. So there I verbally and now given him a picture of an expectation of what will take place. And if he really wants that, if that's what his demand is, I'll use that as the lure to get him out and get the hostage out if I can.
And that's the important thing, is the safety of the hostage.
Absolutely.
Clint Van Zandt's here. The media that I've been watching kind of have their knickers in a knot. They want more information about the, like, the camera, for example, that they used
driving
to get
them
the
crazy. In fact, I just got a call earlier from the media. They're trying desperately to find out what type of camera device was used, how it was introduced in there. And the FBI has already said publicly, you know, we're not going to give everything up. Dana, you and I know that every time we have one of these, it becomes a training video for future criminals, crazies, and terrorists. And they say, okay, this is how the RCMP, or this is how the FBI is going to respond, and these are the resources that they bring to scene. I mean, we have arrested bad guys when I was an FBI agent years ago who would have law enforcement bulletins, magazines in their possession, and they were reading up on police tactics so they knew what would happen. So the last thing in the world the FBI wants to do is give up some of these devices that are military in nature or intelligence agency in nature that have taken sometimes years and hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars to develop. You're not going to give that up and let that be paraded on television and have Al-Qaeda say, okay, that's what they're going to use. So if we take hostages in America, realize that's what's going to happen to us, and how do we stop that? And it's just going to frustrate the media, and sometimes that's just a good lesson the media needs.
Well, they need to know that you can't give all your tactics away, because what's the old saying, Clint? We're there to protect life and property, and protecting life and property isn't giving your techniques to the media. It's just that simple. Clint,
no, it's not. You know, even last week, I saw some of the television networks, they were going and interviewing some of his neighbors, and of course the neighbors didn't like the guy.
Yeah.
They were ranting and raging, and he's a survivalist, and he walks around with guns, and he shoots bullets over our head, and he beat my dog to death with a lead pipe, and all those things are likely true, but you know, you've got this guy who's got a TV down in that bunker and a radio down in that bunker. So he's listening to those negative things, and then when the negotiator talks to him, the negotiator has to fight past all that and get him back on topic and get him back on subject and get him perhaps believing or thinking that he could come out, not only make those statements, but come out and maybe fight the charges against him. And sometimes the media really doesn't help in a situation like that.
What about that negotiator? You're in a scene, a domestic situation, husband, wife, bank robbery, you have customers hostage, but here you have a five-year-old little boy. And you as the negotiator are going in there to do what you can to save that life of that little boy. The thoughts that are going through the mind of that person.
Well, you know, I did the same thing. As you know, I wrote a book called Facing Down Evil, Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And one of the situations I talk about was a five-year-old boy and his mother who were kidnapped and taken out to a remote site here in Virginia and held hostage. The woman was sexually assaulted. The subject threatened the lives of both. And make a long story short, in that case, we used a helicopter as a visual stimulus. The hostage taker, we led him to believe that we would use the helicopter and fly him to another remote location. We let him watch us load food onto the helicopter. I let him talk us out of two pilots down to one pilot. We created this expectation of success. He came out with the little boy sitting on his shoulder, his legs wrapped around the hostage taker's neck. He had the woman in front of him. He had a knife to her throat, a gun to the back of her head, and these three are moving in unison toward the helicopter. And by previous plan, we take the helicopter, we take off. We take off at an angle where we throw dirt and dust. We think we're going to maybe knock him down with the rotor wash. As the subject drops down to one knee, pulls the woman down with a little boy sitting, legs drooped around the subject's neck. He's got the gun to the woman's head, jams it to the head, and says to her, "Goodbye, kitten." And as she's waiting for that bullet to come smashing into her head, an FBI HRT sniper from about 65 yards away put a bullet in his head, and we took him out. And, you know, we were within half a second of losing the woman, maybe losing the little boy. And you know how, Dana, you and I in law enforcement, I had people say to me later, you talk about that, and they'd say, well, you know, how did you know he was really going to shoot? Should you have waited? Well, you know, sometimes, Dana, we got to realize that law enforcement officers are paid to make those calls. And nobody's perfect, and we don't do these things in a vacuum, and you make the best call with the best information, and you hope you're right. And, you know, if you're right, you're right, and if you're wrong, somebody dies in a situation like that.
It's a learning experience, education. Clint, you know as well as I do, tomorrow, next week, next day, your phone's going to ring. There's going to be another situation out there somewhere.
Yep.
Somebody's going to have somebody hostage, another shooting. whatever. I'm going to ask you to put your media hat on now because you do both. What can the media do better in a situation like this? One of the things you and I talked about with Sandy Hook is it just drove me nuts to see them trying to interview these little kids. If I could have reached through the TV screen, I would have strangled some of those reporters. What can they do better?
Yeah. Well, you know, number one, try not to interject yourself into negotiations. You know, I've seen some television personalities who have some of these criminal talk shows try to inject themselves into an ongoing case or an ongoing situation by sharing their opinion without thinking that the bad guys are listening. I remember a situation that took place at a college in California, a hostage situation inside of a bar restaurant where the hostages were being held, women were being sexually assaulted by the hostage taker. A decision was made to send a SWAT team in and resolve it tactically. The television station at that time was running live feed, and they showed the tactical team making an entry to the building. The subject is sitting inside the bar watching the television, watching live the SWAT team come from outside. And the only thing that saved that situation was that he thought they were coming in, let's say, the door on the right.
Yep.
And when in reality he had it confused and they came through the door on the left. When they came, of course, he had to do a 180-degree turn to face them. By that time, the SWAT team was able to deal with him tactically. But it was that close. Otherwise, it could have been a bloodbath. And I remember we had a conference at the FBI Academy at the time when we brought media people in. And we said, look at this situation. Look how bad that would have been for running live feed at that time. And, you know, you got to understand you can't do that in these situations. And we had some very famous newscasters at the time agree, but, you know, they move on. Then you get these young broadcasters and reporters. They all want to go national, and they figure the way they're going to do it is either dodge bullets in Iraq or get in the middle of a hostage situation in America, and it starts all over again.
Yeah, there you go. Clint, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's retired FBI agent Clint Van Zandt. Expert at hostage negotiations, criminal profiling, been there, done that. He preached the gospel with David Koresh while he was trying to settle that situation. And it's a tough road to hoe for sure. Jimmy Lee Dykes, there's a special place in hell for him. And we're all glad that the little boy is safe. We're going to take a break here on Scared Monkeys Radio and come back with former senior official with the Saskatchewan and Manitoba governments, someone who was arrested for murder, found not guilty, and is now writing a book about his experience in remand. Mark Stobey will be here. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Mark Stobey was a senior communications official with the government of Manitoba when his wife, Beverly Robothan, was brutally murdered in October of 2000. 8 years later, he was charged with second-degree murder. After spending close to 2 months incarcerated, he was released on bail until his trial began in the Manitoba Court of Queen's Bench on March 29, 2012. He was acquitted by a jury of his peers, and he's here tonight to talk about his book, Lessons from Remand. Now, we're not going to rehash the trial. That's all public record. We want to talk to Mark about the book, Lessons from Remand, and how important that is to those that just don't understand the system. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, good to have you to be on.
When you look at this, now you were a senior official with not only the Manitoba government but the Saskatchewan government. You end up your wife is murdered. You're arrested. You're put in jail. I could ask probably the dumbest question that you've ever been asked. Why did you write the book?
What struck me about, first of all, to take a step back, before I was arrested, my understanding of what jail was like was based on movies and books and films.
Right.
What I actually saw, at least in remand facilities, was something very different. What struck me was you've got a group of people who have been disrupted from their lives. The police have grabbed them and put them in handcuffs and trundled them off. They're locked in a room with strangers, usually three to a room about the size of most people's bathroom. Their future's uncertain. Many of them are undergoing some sort of withdrawal from drug and alcohol. There's nothing to do. The food is terrible. A third of them are sleeping on the floor. And yet, with all of that, there's remarkably little conflict, and people get along remarkably well.
Mark Stobie's here talking about his new book, Lessons from Remand. If you click on the link in the show notes, it'll take you to Amazon, and I'm sure there are other locations where you can find the book. When you mentioned jail itself and only knowing it from television and the movies, maybe books, most people listening to the program or watching on television will agree with you. Getting back to the situation of being arrested 8 years later, how much of a shock was it to be arrested?
It's a shock. I mean, I'd known for a long time that the police were looking with suspicion in my direction, shall we say. And there'd been indications through the media and so on that something could well be happening in the reasonably near future prior to my arrest. So it wasn't sort of out of the blue, but it's still a shock.
When you mentioned the media, and again, I'm not sure how much you cover that or mention it in the book, but how influential was the media as far as your case?
This is not covered in the book about, I believe I don't even mention them in the book about being in remand. But in terms of the process leading to my arrest and so on, I think that the media played a significant role in continuing to. I mean, it's a complicated story, but the process by which the file was transferred from one set of prosecutors based in Alberta to another one in British Columbia rose directly out of media applications to get information released about the case.
We don't cover crime like the United States, Nancy Grace, for example. But when you write the book, or you're in remand, and we're going to get more into just exactly what remand is in a minute here. What do you do when you were approached by the media? What do you do? And I'll ask you, were you ever asked to give interviews prior to your trial?
Oh, absolutely. Not so much between arrest and trial, but pre-arrest, media was interested. I mean, in fact, about 10 days after my wife was killed, one TV reporter from a TV station requested that I come and do a live on-air polygraph test.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
You know, that's an extreme example, but that's the kind of level of media scrutiny that somebody's under when they're a suspect in a crime such as this.
Joe and Mary Sixpack out there listening to the program may not understand what remand is. What is remand?
Remand is jail for people who haven't been convicted yet. Despite the saying that you're innocent until proven guilty, people still get locked up prior to being convicted. The logic is to prevent either the person from fleeing or committing other crimes if there's grounds for believing that they've committed the first one. Right now in Canada, about 53% of the people who are locked up in jail have not been convicted of the crime that they're locked up for.
In remand, and I believe you were in Winnipeg remand, typically, well, you're there on a murder charge. Typically, what type of prisoner do you meet at remand?
Anybody and everybody. I saw people of pretty much every race, age. there's people in there, you know, business people passing through who were picked up for impaired driving, to people charged with murder, sexual assault, you name it, they're there.
The biggest nightmare in your life is playing out for you. Your wife is murdered. You're now arrested in remand. Sitting there the first night, share that with us.
Well, the first night, I was actually in Saskatoon prior to transfer to Winnipeg, and I was in solitary confinement in the Saskatoon Correctional Center. It's just a long night. I mean, there's, you know, you're alone with your thoughts. Once in the remand center itself, there's other people, and there were other people in the room with me. Sort of after lights out, there's, you hear through the different cells people sort of conversing. It's a time where some people feel brave enough to issue threats to other people, so you hear that sort of chatter going back and forth, which tended not to happen during the daytime when they could actually see each other. So you sort of sit there listening to that conversation and quite frankly wonder if this is the first day of the rest of your life.
Mark Stolbe's here, reminding the audience that on the 29th of March 2012, he was acquitted by a jury of his peers on the charge of second-degree murder. When we get into the book itself and the system, we all follow the news, the conservative government, the taking away the two-for-one deal to try and get speedy trials, all of this look at the judicial system the way that we have it. Like you say, anywhere from impaired driving to murder in remand. What about the system itself in Canada? Are we doing the right thing? What can be changed?
To me, the very biggest thing that needs to change is the speed at which things go to trial or resolve and plea. I mean, in my case, for example, it was almost 4 years between charge and acquittal. Now, fortunately, I wasn't in jail that whole time, but I still had fairly significant restrictions on my freedom, and my life was on hold in many ways for that 4 years. You know, there were people, I met one of them, his trial started the same day as mine, who had been in remand with. He hadn't got bail. He was acquitted. He spent 4 years in jail for a crime he didn't commit. Even more minor crimes, you know, it commonly takes a year to 2 years for a charge to be dealt with. And people are either in remand on that during that time, or more commonly they're out on some sort of conditional release, but there's all sorts of restrictions on their freedom. They're in and out. They get tossed back in jail for trivial and minor violations of their conditions, such that they can have, you know, a number of charges accumulated before their main charge actually is ever dealt with. It chews up huge amounts of court and police time. You know, if there's a single thing that needs to be fixed about the justice system, it's the speed at which it moves.
Mark Stolbe's here talking about his new book, Lessons from Remand. Share with the audience your experience with the biker.
Well, the biker story. I mean, there was a biker in there that was actually facing a couple murder charges. We got along fairly well. One day, it was actually my second or third day there, I made a social error. I entered the shower to have a shower without thinking too much of it, and inadvertently, I mean, it was a big, huge shower facility and, you know, sort of a dozen shower heads and stuff. there was a young Native guy in there, and he just reacted with terror when I walked in. I realized that I'd made a mistake by going in with when somebody else was there, and so the biker afterwards came and had a little chat with me to impress upon me that the rule was one person in the shower at a time. And he was fairly blunt about the way he phrased it, and sort of the significance that was drawn by other people by violating that rule that I didn't know about.
Mark, when you write the book, and the book is published and it's being sold, some critics will say, why should you profit from this tragedy? That's my term. How do you reply to that?
Well, I would say that, first of all, I haven't profited. It would take a exceptionally good bestseller. I mean, it would need to be in the range of Harry Potter to cause this whole process to result in a financial profit for me. You know, I expect a couple of $1,000 in royalties out of this book. That will barely make a dent in the money that I still owe in legal fees. There's no profit here.
The book, again, Lessons from Remand, and this is my final question, the biggest lesson for you?
I would say the nature of human optimism, that one of the things that struck me about the people in Remand is, for the most part, they, strangely enough, were all sort of hopeful about the future, hopeful that something would change in their lives, hopeful that they wouldn't be back there. And that sturdiness of human optimism, I think, is something that is, in difficult circumstances, can be both quite inspiring. Of course, it was, in some cases, optimism that got them in there in the first place, in terms of being overly optimistic about their prospects of criminal success, let's say.
Right.
But in difficult circumstances, optimism was a fairly remarkable beast.
The book, Lessons from Remand, click on the link in the show notes. It'll take you to Amazon. Mark Stobie, appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I guess you wonder, the family, the Robotham family, are wondering about the optimism that they have for justice. Mark Stobie's book, Lessons from Remand, is available from Amazon. Click on the link on the show notes. I guess the adage, innocent until proven guilty, is something that we do respect in North America. And he was acquitted by a jury of his peers. Fred Rosen is working on his book, Sisters in Murder. He's always a character, one to follow up and read his books. He's an excellent author, and I can't wait to see the movie. That's it. That's tonight's show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.